The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest. Jason L. Riley's books include Let Them In, The Case for Open Borders, False Black Power, and Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed. A longtime columnist for the Wall Street Journal and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, he widely lectures and offers commentary about important social and political issues on various media outlets. Mr. Riley's latest work is called Maverick, a biography of conservative social theorist Thomas Sowell. It offers a portrait of the Jim Crow South orphan's evolution to public intellectual while arguing that academia should reconsider the unsentimental theorist's views. One review calls it, quote, a brilliant intellectual biography of one of the most important thinkers of our time. Jason Riley writes lucidly and engagingly, illuminating ideas of souls that are more timely today than ever, dispelling many myths along the way. Tonight, he will be in conversation with Anthony B. Bradley, professor and chair of religious and theological studies at King's College of New York. He is also a research fellow at the Acton Institute. His writings on religious and cultural issues have been published in a variety of journals, including the Philly Inquirer, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and the Detroit Free News. The Detroit News. Thank you so much for being here, and take it away.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks so much for having us tonight. I am thrilled to be having this conversation with Jason Riley about one of my intellectual heroes as well, Thomas Sowell. Jason, I'm curious to know what made you decide to write this book on Thomas Sowell?
Well, he's someone who's had a tremendous impact on my own personal intellectual development. He's someone I discovered in college back in the early 1990s. I worked on the school paper, and I was sitting around with some of my colleagues on the paper discussing affirmative action one day, and someone said, Jason, you sound like Tom Sowell. And I said, Tom who? And the person wrote down the name of a book on a sheet of paper, and I went to the school library that day and checked it out and read it in one sitting that evening, and went back to the school library the next day and checked out its entire collection of Thomas Sowell works, and have been hooked ever since. And I got to meet Sowell for the first time in the mid-90s while working on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. He would come through New York on book tours and meet with editorial boards. And so that's when I first met him in person. And then I later, in the mid-2000s, went out to California to the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, where he's based, and wrote up a profile of him. And that's when we sort of struck up an acquaintance that has endured. And pretty much since then, since the mid-2000s, I had been trying to get him to cooperate on a biography. I was surprised to know he didn't have a biographer. And then a little more surprised to find out he didn't want one. and it took a little persuading, years and years of persuading, actually. I could write it without his cooperation. He encouraged me to do that, but I thought it would be a better book if he did sit for some long interviews, and he finally agreed to do that. And, you know, I think that, frankly, it's tragic to me that names like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Ibram Kendi and Nicole Hannah Jones and Cornel West are known to people, but not Thomas Sowell. I think, frankly, in terms of his scholarship, he's written circles around those individuals. Maybe around all of them put together, frankly. And it's not just the breadth of his writings, the various disciplines that he has dabbled in, you know, intellectual history, sociology, social theorist, political philosophy, and so forth. It's also the rigor and depth of his thinking that I think is far and away above those other names I mentioned. And so part of my reason in wanting to write this book was to raise his profile, to introduce him perhaps to some younger folks who haven't come across him, or maybe raise his profile among people who have. And so that was the real impetus in doing it.
Yeah, it's really quite extraordinary that more people do not know who he is. I mean, he's written dozens and dozens of books. He has been really influential for me. One of the things that I noted about Sol is he almost publishes a book every year. And I used him for my dissertation, and I was getting frustrated because every time I thought I was had enough content, he published a new book, and I had to go and read that. And I needed to get my dissertation done. So, you know, as he continued to write, you know, Thomas Sowell has a very interesting story. You know, people often engage him. They get introduced to him through his books. They get introduced to him through his work at the Hoover Institution. But many people are not aware of his family background and how he grew up. I mean, there is this sense that, you know, Sowell is this ivory tower elite who doesn't really understand the issues of poverty or family brokenness. He's just talking in abstraction. Can you tell us a little bit about his family background, how he grew up, and why that's not true?
More directly. Yeah. So Sowell is going to be 91 years old later this month. And as you said, he's been extremely prolific. He published a book last year on his birthday. About school choice, a book about charter schools. So he's still at it. He retired his column, which he'd written for decades back in 2016, but he is still working on books, either new books or updating editions of old books that he's written. But he was born in 1930 in the Jim Crow South in North Carolina outside of Charlotte. So this is the Depression. He was born into an extremely poor family. He was orphaned as a toddler, never knew his father, who died before he was born. And his mother died in childbirth to a younger brother of Tom's. So he didn't know his parents. He was taken in by a distant relative, a great aunt, who moved the family first to Charlotte and then up north to Harlem when Tom was 9 years old, part of that great Black migration at the time. And that's where he was raised. In the 30s and 40s in Harlem. He had a rather tumultuous home life. He was a bright kid, a very bright student, but he had a tumultuous home life. He ended up dropping out of high school. Tom never graduated from high school, and then leaving home at the age of 17, sort of striking out on his own. And he wandered around for a few years and then was drafted into the military during the Korean War, into the Marines. And served 2 years in the Marines. And he sort of started to turn his life around there and got out, was able to attend college on the GI Bill. And he started out at Howard University, the Black school in DC, then transferred to Harvard. Then it was on to Columbia for his master's in economics, and then on to the University of Chicago for his PhD, where he studied under people like Milton Friedman and George Stigler, who were leading economists of the 20th century. And he spent, you know, his first love was always teaching. It wasn't research, it was classroom teaching. Tom wanted to be an economics professor. And his first discipline was economic history, writing about the classical liberal economists, John Stuart Mill, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, Jean-Baptiste Say, folks like that. That was his real expertise. And that's what he wanted to spend his days doing. And that's what he did in the 1960s. He taught at everywhere from Rutgers University to Cornell. He taught, continued teaching in the 70s. Amherst, Brandeis, ended up at UCLA in the late 70s and stayed there, got tenure. And then in 1980, left teaching for good. And we can talk about why he decided to do that, but he left it for good in 1980 and joined the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, where he's been ever since.
Yeah, I would love to explore just a moment what happened, right? I mean, here's a man who had the academic credentials. He had been publishing in economic journals. Mm-hmm. He was teaching, and then he just stopped teaching. And mm-hmm. and if people knew a little bit about his personality, they might not be surprised, right? I'm actually surprised, to be honest, that you got to meet him. And you got that close to him, as some people may not know. He's a bit of a recluse. I often tell people he doesn't like big crowds, doesn't like a lot of people. In fact, Walter Williams told me that only about 5 or 6 people even had his phone number, right? and so he's not super social that way. But he was in the academy, and then mm-hmm. he left. Yeah. Why? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. You have to remember, this was the 1960s, and you have to put it in the context of what was going on in the academy in the 1960s. The university was changing. The culture on campuses was changing. This was a time when you had not only a sort of Black civil rights movement going on, you had a women's rights movement, you had a gay rights movement, you had an anti-war movement. And all of these movements used the college campuses as platforms. And universities were very tumultuous places at the time. They didn't quite know how to handle what was going on. All the protesters, all the activists. What is our role nowadays? Has it changed from what it used to be, and so forth? And Sol was pretty old school. He wanted to teach the way he had been taught in the 1950s, in particular. So no, you could not be excused from class to go to a protest. No, we are not going to spend the entire period talking about the latest headlines in the news. I'm here to teach economics, you're here to learn economics, and that's what we're going to discuss. No, I will not grade on the curve. No, you can't audit my class. He was very, very much old school. And that led to constant run-ins with administrators and faculties over his tough grading, over his sort of no-nonsense persona. And so the academy was changing in ways that Sol refused to accommodate. And this all reached a head, I think, when he was at Cornell in the late 1960s, when you had the student militants taking over the campus buildings. Armed students taking over the campus buildings. And Sol was rather disgusted at the way the administrators simply capitulated to the demands of these students, that there were no real adults on campus anymore. And I think it really soured him on the academy, that experience. And he stuck it out for another decade, the 1970s, but I think he sort of had one foot out the door of the academy. He started to do write for more popular publications, joined the think tank world in various degrees throughout the 1970s. And then he made a clean break when he got the offer from Hoover, which was essentially to focus on research and without any teaching responsibilities or classroom duties. And so we have the books and the columns, but we don't have the legions of graduate students that might have studied under Thomas Sol. So there's been a trade-off.
Sure, and it's really fascinating because I think it's true that perhaps at one point in his life he might have been sympathetic to some of the ideas and some of the protesters in the 60s because he didn't always hold the views that he holds.
No.
Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct, and it's an important point to make. Tom started out on the left, and not just slightly left of center. Thomas Sol was a Marxist in his youth. And we need to keep this in perspective. It was not uncommon. It's not uncommon today for a lot of people who identify as conservatives to have started out on the left. Milton Friedman, who I mentioned earlier, is known today as this free market icon. He started out on the left. Ronald Reagan started out on the left. There are any number of conservatives. Walter Williams, who you mentioned earlier, this another free market economist and very close friend of Thomas Sol, was much more sympathetic to the views of Malcolm X than he was to the views of Martin Luther King in his youth. Shelby Steele, a race scholar at the Hoover Institution, where Sol is, was a leftist radical in the 1960s. So Clarence Thomas was a Black Panther. So it's not uncommon, and particularly for Blacks, conservatives, to have started out, again, not just slightly left of center, but to be a real committed leftist. And sort of Sol is in that tradition. He was, after he dropped out of school, he picked up a secondhand set of encyclopedias and was taken in by an entry on Karl Marx. And he was a sort of self-taught Marxist through his late teens. And he talks about the attraction of Marxism at the time. So this would be the late 1940s. He's a high school dropout. He's working as a messenger for Western Union in New York City. And they're located in Lower Manhattan, down in the Wall Street area. And after work some days, he would take a double-decker bus back home up in Harlem. And he talks about the bus ride and how the landscape would change as he moved north through Wall Street and then up Fifth Avenue, past Saks Fifth Avenue, the ritzy shopping district in Manhattan, and then past Carnegie Hall, and then up Riverside Drive into this ritzy residential neighborhood at the time. And then he would cross this viaduct, and there would be the tenements, the ghetto, where he would get off. And he would look around and say, what just happened? Why does this look like this up here versus where I started out? And he said Marx explained that to him in coherent terms that he could readily understand. This was about exploitation. This was about the capitalist versus the proletariat. And Tom said that had a certain attraction to him. And all through his both undergraduate days in college, as well as through his graduate days when he was studying economics under these free market icons like Milton Friedman and George Stigler, Tom Sol remained a Marxist. He said it was a job in the government that got him to reevaluate his thinking about socialism in general. He was working for the Department of Labor in the early 1960s and was studying the effects of minimum wage laws on employment, and particularly on the employment of lower income minority groups. And he noticed that there was a negative impact on employment, and it forced him to sort of reevaluate not just his affinity for minimum wage laws at the time, but just the whole notion that government is this benevolent force when it comes to helping the disadvantaged. And that is what started him on his path away from socialism. And it's interesting that if you read his memoir, my book is more of an intellectual biography. And one of the reasons I could focus on his ideas is because he had already written a memoir and he'd written a book of correspondence as well that this is someone, just as an aside, who had the foresight going all the way back to the 1960s. He had not only kept copies of letters he had received from other people over the decades, he had made carbons of letters he sent to other people and kept them, going all the way back to at least the 1960s. And in the mid-2000s, he published a book called A Man of Letters, which was just reprinting this correspondence that he had saved. And you get, I think it's even more intimate than his memoir, because you really get into the evolution of his own thinking dating all the way back to the late 50s and early 1960s. And it's quite remarkable. But you do get the sense of how it wasn't just book learning, but life experience that informs Sol's odyssey intellectually. And I'll give you another example of something that happened to him that informed his thinking going forward. Back in the late 1950s, he got a job, just a summer internship while he was in undergraduate school at the US Public Health Service in Washington, DC, working at the headquarters there. And one day a man had a heart attack on the sidewalk outside of the building. And the man was brought in to the building, to the nurse's office. But it was determined that because he wasn't a government employee, he couldn't be treated there. And so they called an ambulance so that he could be taken someplace where he could be treated. And the man died before the ambulance arrived. And for Sol, this sort of crystallized or dramatized, I should say, the nature of bureaucracies and bureaucratic thinking and the focus on procedure and process over actual results. And he says in his memoir, the way he puts it is, a man died waiting for a doctor in a building full of doctors. It made no sense. And that is, you know, it's the sort of life experience that has informed Tom's thinking and attitude towards some of these topics he's written about over the decades.
So he's had the experience of living within the context of poverty as a high school dropout, struggled there, went to great schools, was heavily influenced by great thinkers, right? Nobel Prize laureates at the University of Chicago and at Columbia. And they really had a massive influence on his thinking. But it's not true. He often gets sort of typecast as a parrot of the right. But he's an independent thinker, right? I mean, if I could use one word to describe Thomas Sowell, it is independence.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about how he's an independent thinker?
Well, you could have asked his mentors. They would have been the first ones to tell you, George Stigler and Milton Friedman. You know, Tom was a Marxist when he started at Chicago. He was a Marxist when he finished at Chicago. They knew it. He knew it. Although it's interesting, that never got in the way of how Stigler and Friedman viewed this young man at the time. They saw something in this guy, to the point where they took a vested interest in making sure he succeeded in his studies. There was a point where Sowell was going through some financial difficulties and was thinking of dropping out of the University of Chicago, dropping out of graduate school and getting a job. And without his knowledge, Stigler and Friedman went to a foundation to secure a grant for him that would allow him to continue his studies. They didn't even tell him until they had gotten the money. And then they just handed him an envelope and said, you know, take a look at this when you get a chance. And Sowell writes about how that enabled him to finish his studies and go on to become an economist. And it's funny because when they went to a foundation called the Earhart Foundation at the time, it's now defunct, but it was run by a man named Richard Ware. And Ware has talked about how when Friedman and Stigler came to him and said, we've got a young academic star, you guys should fund him, you should support his work and his studies. He says their word was good enough for us because of their prominence. And in the letter they wrote recommending a grant for Sowell, Stigler and Friedman said, he's a socialist now, but he's too smart to stay that way. So they knew at the time that he did not agree with them ideologically. Stigler was his dissertation advisor, and they regularly came to blows intellectually over his dissertation. Never agreed, in fact, in the end, on his interpretation of some economic theory that Tom wanted to write about. They discouraged him. One of his early teaching jobs was at Howard University. He had attended the school as an undergraduate, and then went back there to teach while he was working on his PhD. And they had said to him, you know, you could get jobs at much more prestigious institutions with better reputations than Howard. And in terms of your own career, you might want to consider taking these other offers, not the one from Howard. Tom did not pay them any mind at all. He knew what he wanted to do when he went. And he went to Howard and taught there. And so Tom has been an independent thinker. And one of the things I mentioned that book of correspondence that he wrote. And that's one way you can sort of double check this stuff, because it's there in writing what he was thinking about various issues. Again, going all the way back to the late 50s and early 60s, this is not, you don't have to take his word for it. This is what he truly believed. He wrote it down at the time.
Yes, and it's so fascinating. I mean, I've read almost everything he's written, and I am amazed at how he has no problem upsetting people. He doesn't seek to please people at all. And so his views really are his. And one of the things that I appreciate about Thomas Sowell is his emphasis on data, right? People often ask him, hey, why is it that you became such a different thinker sort of in the sort of black context? He's like, the data, right?
Yeah.
The data. And what's really important about his books is the use of data. Can you talk about how he uses data?
Sure. That's the sort of Chicago school empiricism that the University of Chicago is famous for. Following the data, following the facts, and also an emphasis on solving or addressing at least real world problems. At a number of other schools, economic departments, prominent economics departments, MIT, Harvard, and so forth, economics is more about elegant models, theoretical economics. It's mathematical. It's about theory. At Chicago, it was about using economics to address real world situations, following the data where it leads, and less about theory per se or for its own sake. And so I think Tom brought that sort of thinking with him to Chicago, but that was certainly emphasized at Chicago. And in terms of his independent streak, it's also been showcased in his ability or willingness, I should say, to cross even people who he agrees with on many issues most of the time. So he disagreed with Milton Friedman on some economics issues like negative income tax at the time. This has now come back into the news as universal basic income, but this was something Milton Friedman supported back in the 70s and 80s. Tom wrote against it repeatedly. A more recent example would be his disagreements with Charles Murray over his writings on race and intelligence. Tom has excoriated Murray's attempts to present a case of hereditary factors as the main driver of intelligence test score differences and so forth. And has not been shy about it. I mean, Murray is someone he's, you know, written nice things about on welfare reform and other areas where Murray's written. But on this area, Tom has been rather merciless. And it actually began before Murray. People look at his critiques of the bell curve, but Tom had really looked into this issue back in the 1970s to address the writings of a scholar named Arthur Jensen. You have to keep in mind how old Tom is, but Jensen was a psychologist who had written about sort of genetic determinism and had argued that because these gaps that we saw in intelligence scores persisted, this was genetically based, and because it was genetically based, programs like Head Start that were, you know, designed to address these academic achievement gaps were really going to be useless because this is all genetic. And Tom took it upon himself to do his own studies, his own research to address what Jensen was saying, to prove him wrong. He wasn't just interested in calling him names or ignoring him, just as he wasn't in doing the same with Murray. He said, let's take on these arguments. And what's interesting is that there were a number of Black scholars at the time who learned that Tom was looking into this and urged him to stop. Mm-hmm. Prominent Black academics that said, do not engage Jensen on this. And Tom has said he thinks that they were afraid of what he might find. And Tom was not afraid. He said, you know, I think Jensen's wrong, but what if he's right? Are we supposed to ignore it? You know, if you want to help people, you have to find out where they are, because they can only get where you want them to get from where they are, not from where you hope they are or you want them to be. And this is a debate that continues today
over testing SAT scores. We have schools that are saying we're going to do away with the SAT test because of the racially disparate outcomes. And eliminating the test isn't going to eliminate the gaps. That's a cop out. It's only going to obscure where the gaps are. And so Tom was quite fearless in this work. And he, his research turned up a number of factors that really undermined Jensen's theories. He found that there were all Black schools all outperforming all white schools. There were Southern soldiers in World War I, white soldiers whose test scores were lower than Black Northern soldiers. There were Black women were overrepresented among people with the highest IQs of everyone. All of this undermined a genetic explanation for these differences, and on and on. And so Tom presented his results, but it is a sign that it shows that he has been willing to take on even people he's largely agreed with ideologically when he thinks they are wrong. He doesn't care. He's someone who is searching for the truth.
And that's really come to shape the sorts of questions that he asked. And what I want to turn to quickly before we take some questions are those ideas. He's had some key ideas, some key books. And what I want to ask you about is how some of these ideas have really come to shape so much of what he's written. He had a massive impact with the book Knowledge and Decisions. It really had a pretty big influence in shaping so much of everything else that he wrote after that. And in your book, you sort of mention so much of the framework theory. Can you tell us a little bit about what Knowledge and Decisions is about?
Sure. This is a book about social theory. And it's building on the work of an economist named Friedrich Hayek, who's most famous for The Road to Serfdom, a book that really critiques socialism in Europe in particular. Basically, it's a book about decision making and how people make decisions. It's a book about price theory. And how prices help people in society decide what they want, what they need, what they can have, how much of it should be produced, and so forth, and how this system is superior to a sort of top-down level of thinking on these things, that we will decide that the price of bread should be this, or the price of car should be this, or there should be this many Burger Kings in society, and so forth. That the free market is a superior way of allocating resources and labor and so forth, and that prices are the best way to determine how those resources should be allocated. So it's a book about social theory and decision making, and also on another level, it's a book about how you want the people who make decisions to suffer the consequences of being wrong. And to the extent that there is a gap growing between the people who make decisions for society and whether or not they will suffer any consequences for being wrong, we're headed on the wrong path. And he called out a lot of the trends that were going on at the time in the late 70s. I think, unfortunately, he's been quite prescient in the way things have panned out. So the book remains incredibly relevant today. Yeah.
And he also in that book is going to talk about, as Hayek does, the knowledge problem, right? The
yes.
the idea that intellectuals believe yeah. themselves to know enough information mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C. to make decisions for 330 million people in right. towns and states that they don't even know and they can't even see. And that,
yeah.
that's really been important for him.
Absolutely. The problem, as he writes in places like the Soviet Union, is that the people with the power didn't have the knowledge, and the people with the knowledge didn't have the power. And that was the big problem. that the idea that some bureaucrats can sit around and think real hard about what things should cost and who should have access to them was folly to begin with. And it's why a free market system that allows these sort of decision-making units, whether it's the family, whether it's religion, whether it's a political party, but these are all decision-making units that give people immediate feedback in terms of knowledge of what's going on. And to the extent that you lessen that or take away from that or usurp that from above, you're headed in the wrong direction. And that's, yes, that was a very important point of, that he was trying to make in that book. Yeah.
In the classes that I teach at the King's College, I use Thomas Sowell's books quite a lot. And one of the books that my students absolutely love that I say everyone needs to read this Thomas Sowell book is A Conflict of Visions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that book is a book that essentially says there's these sort of anthropological disagreements that we have about public policy. Can you explain to us what these visions are and how it works in public policy?
So A Conflict of Visions is a book about political philosophy, and it sort of argues that many of our political and social disputes that we have today over various social policies can be traced back first hundreds of years to thinkers like William Godwin in the 1700s and Adam Smith and Rousseau, on down through John Rawls and so forth. And they really, these conflicts result from, broadly speaking, two conflicting views of human nature and how the world works. And he identifies them as the constrained and the unconstrained vision. Sometimes he calls the constrained vision the tragic vision or tragic view, and the unconstrained view the utopian view. And the constrained vision is describing someone who believes there are limits to human betterment, that who was a Kant that said from the crooked timber of humanity, no truly straight thing can ever be made. That is your classic tragic view. There are problems in the world that we'd all love to solve: war, poverty, racism. But we're unlikely to ever fully eliminate these problems. And so the best we can do is to create institutions and processes that help us deal with problems we're probably never ever going to solve entirely. So we may want war to go, to go away, and world peace and so forth, but it's probably not going to happen. So it's probably a good idea to build a military. We may want crime to end and racism and so forth, but that too is probably not going to happen. So we need a court system to adjudicate disputes to the best of our ability. And he contrasts that with this more utopian, unconstrained view, which says, no, we can not only manage these problems, we can solve them. It's just a matter of willpower. It's just a matter of using our powers of reason. And furthermore, there will be no trade-offs. We can solve these problems entirely, and everyone will be better off. And Sowell says that these two views of human nature, these two views of how the world work, will tell you a lot about how people will come down on a public policy dispute, on everything from taxes to regulation to rent control to affirmative action to antitrust law and so forth. And if you really want to get inside of Tom's head and understand where he's coming from on any number of areas that he writes about, whether it's the civil rights leadership or education reform or economic history, this is the book to read. He really lays out this intellectual framework in which he is addressing these issues, and it's part of an informal trilogy that he wrote. The first was A Conflict of Visions, and then he wrote The Vision of the Anointed. And the third book was called The Quest for Cosmic Justice. And the latter two books are more about critiquing the various visions and as a result are a little more polemical, because Tom doesn't hide the fact that he shares that more constrained and tragic view. But A Conflict of Visions really just lays out this framework in which to address these various disputes that we have, a way to understand where people are coming from.
In fact, it's such a good book. I don't know if you know this, but they actually use The Conflict of Visions at Harvard Law School in a course on human nature. Theories of human nature at Harvard Law. The Conflict of Visions is one of the books. It's really an extraordinary opportunity for people to see the world in mm-hmm. completely new ways. And my students absolutely love it because it opens them up, and they see these differences immediately in our political discourse. It does an excellent job of equipping you to be able to drill down to the core issues in any public policy that comes up in the news. I want to move to some of the questions that we're getting from the audience.
Sure.
One person is curious to know how the book affected you personally, and if there were any disagreements that you found yourself having with Sol on the research for the book.
No, I don't. There are no real fundamental disagreements that I've had with Sol's work over the years. Differences in degree, perhaps on some issues. But no, not really fundamental disagreements. Like I said, he's someone who's had a huge impact on my own thinking. And so this isn't a book that where I personally take on his arguments, although I do write about others who have taken on his arguments, or more specifically about why others have not engaged Tom on a level that I think he deserves. And I think that is that's quite interesting that very few people have decided to engage Thomas Sowell. A lot of the attacks on his scholarship are more ad hominem, questioning his motives and so forth, rather than actually engaging his work with counterarguments. And I think, and I do write about what I think is behind that.
Well, in fact, someone asked that question directly. Does he care that people don't really, on the one hand, agree with him, but then secondly, do you think he cares that he's not even that widely known across the country?
I don't think that Tom is in it for personal fame and notoriety. You don't write the things he's written, take the positions he's taken, if you view this as a popularity contest. And I think that's one of the things that actually has distinguished him as an intellectual. And unfortunately, it shouldn't. I mean, being a straight shooter, telling it like it is, following the facts where they lead and reporting the results, even when they're unpopular or politically incorrect, should not distinguish you as a scholar. It should be part of the job description. Yet it does today. And that tells us something about where we are. And among intellectuals and among scholars today, that so many are far more interested in popularity than in telling the truth, in avoiding the social media mobs, than in correcting the narrative. And Tom is not someone who has been focused on that. And he has paid a price. He's paid a price professionally. He's paid a price in terms of notoriety. You know, when Tom, we've been talking with Knowledge and Decisions and A Conflict of Visions about Tom's work on political philosophy and social theory and so forth. And he has clearly distinguished himself on that ground. If Tom Sowell had never written a single word about affirmative action, he would be worthy. He'd be someone we'd be talking about because of his work on these other issues. And in fact, most of his writings are not on racial themes. When he decided to engage on some of these racial controversies, particularly in the 1970s. That's when he became, I guess to use today's parlance, when he got canceled. The Black left in particular decided to write him off, decided that he's someone who should not be engaged, whose views should not be taken seriously, and who the media should not turn to for the views of Blacks. And it's been largely successful. You know, as I do, that the mainstream media is by and large controlled by liberals. So is academia. So are the people who hand out the academic awards and prizes and so forth. And Sol has refused to play footsie with these folks over the decades. And yes, I think it has cost him in terms of notoriety and prestige. And it's one of the reasons people know names like Nicole Hannah Jones and Ibram Kendi and Ta-Nehisi Coates and Cornel West, but not Thomas Sowell. But he is, I think, more interested in his ideas getting out there than getting credit for these ideas. He wants the right ideas to prevail. And he's someone who has spent a lifetime pointing out what's been tried, what's worked, and what hasn't worked, both here in the US and around the world, today, yesterday, and 1,000 years ago. And he's laid it out there. And I think he wants that work to be known more so than for people to know who he is personally.
And tell us what you think it might take for him to get a wider audience. Someone wants to know if you think that Sol's work will eventually gain a wider audience in years to come.
I think it will. I think it will endure. I talk about this in the book, some interviews I did with other academics who said it's not only just how prolific he's been. It's his accessibility. He is one of the most accessible academics and scholars you will ever come across. And this is something, that I think he got in some way from his mentors at the University of Chicago, and particularly Milton Friedman, who himself, after leaving teaching, went on to write books for general interest readers, to lecture widely in front of groups that did not include fellow economists and so forth. Friedman believed that the role of a scholar was not just to talk to your peers in language only they can understand. It was to engage the public, the general public, to explain your discipline to them. And Tom really took that to heart. You know, he's written weightier books on tough topics or using all kinds of jargon and so forth for fellow academics. But by and large, most of his books are written in plain English for the general public, as well as a newspaper column that he wrote for decades. Friedman had written for Newsweek after leaving teaching, and Tom wrote a syndicated column, ran in hundreds of papers for many, many years. And again, when he retired that column back in 2016, I said, some people have just lost the best professor they've ever had, even if they never went to college, because Tom had continued to teach through those books and through those columns. And I think that will be his legacy. He's so accessible. The other thing he's been is right. I mean, Tom, and this gets you back to that book of correspondence I mentioned, where he lays out what he was thinking 30, 40, 50 years ago. Tom has been so far ahead of the curve on so many issues. He was an initial supporter of the civil rights movement in the early 1960s. He supported the Brown v. versus Board of Education decision. He quibbled with some of the reasoning that the justices used to reach the conclusion, but he agreed with the conclusion. He agreed with the Civil Rights Act and supported the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And he was a very early supporter of the civil rights movement. Later in the 60s and on into the 70s, he took issue with the direction that the movement was headed. And it wasn't just the radicals, the militarization part of it, where the other side of the movement was headed, where the emphasis was less about equal opportunity and increasingly about special treatment and equal outcomes and special preferences and affirmative action and racial preference and so forth. And he also took issue with their decision in the post-60s era to integrate political institutions, to really emphasize the election of Black officials as this sort of way of addressing, shortcut to addressing inequality, social inequality in other areas. The thinking became at the time, if we can just get more of our own in office, the rest of this stuff will take care of itself. And Sowell had looked at other groups' journey from poverty to prosperity, other minority racial and ethnic groups, and he was very skeptical that this was the way to go, that political power would lead to economic success. And I think he has largely been proven correct in that analysis. So, you know, Tom has been, like I said, ahead of the curve on a lot of these issues over the years, and is why I think he's someone worthy of reading today, and why I think he will continue to be read for the foreseeable future.
And as you mentioned, I mean, he's done a really good job of comparing cultures, right? I mean, there's the Vision trilogy, but there's also the Culture trilogy, right? Race and culture, migrations and culture, conquest and culture. Can you tell us briefly why Thomas Sowell thinks culture matters if you think about public policy?
Well, again, it's following the data. It's empirical evidence that he would point to of how if you have what economists call human capital, the right skills, behaviors, attitudes, and so forth, how that can help a group overcome all manner of barriers, including being hated by the larger society. And he's pointed to examples of this, not only here in the US, but internationally. So you take, for example, the ethnic Chinese in Southeast Asia, a hated group, kept out of certain professions, kept out of certain schools, and so forth, yet have outperformed the majority population, not only academically, but economically. You can look at Japanese Americans here here in the US and what they endured during their periods of mass immigration, everything from lynchings and being attacked violently to internment camps and being banned from owning land in certain states and being kept out of certain professions. Japanese Americans today both outperform white Americans academically and economically, and have for decades. There's example after example of this the world over, going back centuries. Tom would even point to what Black Americans were doing in the first half of the 20th century in terms of advancement versus what happened in the post-60s era when the civil rights movement took its focus off of the development of that human capital and put more of an emphasis on integrating these political institutions and getting more Blacks elected to office, and what the consequences of that have been. The trend lines that you look at in terms of income gaps growing for Blacks in the 1940s and 50s, the strength of the Black family in the 1930s, and for marriage rates and so forth, and educational attainment and so forth, and how we saw these trends sort of crest in the 1960s. And so for folks who want to say the outcomes today are a legacy of slavery or a legacy of Jim Crow, Tom would point you to the advancements being made among generations of Blacks who were much closer to the institution of slavery or actually living during Jim Crow. So this whole idea that racism per se or discrimination is a blanket explanation for disparate outcomes today is something Sowell has written volumes challenging as a notion.
Right. And so he's also, right, sort of blown up the idea that race is the only variable that we should care about, right? We need to care about all of these other things. And one of the questions being asked relates to his views on education. Now, it's interesting, He has a book about late talking children. Can you talk a little bit about his own kids and education in that sense?
Oh, well those are really two separate issues. I mean, he has views on education, but the book on late talking children grew out of a personal experience. He back in the mid 1990s, Tom wrote a column about his son, who had just graduated from college, and in the column he mentioned how late his son had begun talking, and how much stress this caused his parents at the time. The child was almost 4 years old before he started talking, and people thought he was, you know, mentally disabled, autistic, and all the experts they took him to doctor after doctor, teaching him to talk at home didn't seem to work. Nothing seemed to work. Eventually, he started talking on his own, and Tom just wrote a column about how proud he was of his son graduating from college. And after he wrote this column, thousands of letters poured in from other people who had gone through the same thing with their children, or who themselves had been late talkers. And they were they wanted more information on this, and Tom started looking into it, and not much had been written about it. These kids seemed to experience the same sort of patterns of behavior. They were generally very bright kids, had excellent memories. Most of them were boys. A lot of them had musical talent and so forth. Very good at math, and so Tom looked into the research and couldn't find a lot on it, or at least not a lot written in plain English for everyday people to understand. And so set about writing not just one book about it, but two books about it. The second one was called The Einstein Syndrome, I believe. And so it's also how he got in contact with Steven Pinker of Harvard, and the evolutionary psychologist at Harvard, and they struck up a friendship because Pinker's early work had been in language development in children, and so Tom had reached out to Pinker in the course of writing the first book, and they struck up a friendship that has endured to this day.
That's fantastic. You know, people often, I think, forget that people like Thomas Sowell are humans, right?
Yes.
And they have families and children and experiences that really do impact their writing. I've gotten a couple questions as we wrap up here. What can we do, the general public, to make Thomas Sowell's views more widely known? How can we help Thomas Sowell not get canceled? What can the average person do other than reading your book and giving it out to all of their friends and family members to make Thomas Sowell more well known?
Oh, well, you answered the question, Professor. But this whole idea, you know, one of the interesting things about researching the book that I came across is I watched a lot of interviews with Thomas Sowell. And he was often asked a lot of the same questions over and over again. But one that struck me is he would be asked by interviewers, usually a white interviewer, who would say, you know, how does it feel to be someone who goes against the grain of most Blacks in your thinking? And Tom would say, he'd always respond by correcting the premise of the question. And he would say, you don't mean I go against the grain of most Blacks. You mean I go against the grain of most Black intellectuals, most Black elites. He said, and Black elites are no more representative of Black people than white elites are of white people. And that's true, and it remains true. And we could go through issue after issue where Black elites and Black intellectuals part ways with the general public, the general Black public, on everything from school choice, which most Black elites oppose and most Black, everyday Black support, to voter ID laws, which most average Black people support, to racial preferences and college admissions, which most Black, everyday Blacks oppose and most Black elites support, on down the line. This has been true. And if anything, the gap has been growing over the decades. So Sowell has held positions and been saying things that a lot of Black people agree with. Frankly, you know, and the whole self-help message of the anyone who goes to church on a Black church on a Sunday will not, I mean, be surprised by anything that Tom has written about on that front. So this is about changing the conversation among elites who've been canceling Thomas Sowell all this time out of self-interest. I mean, you mentioned Knowledge and Decisions is a book about intellectuals. One of the points he makes in that book is that we need to view intellectuals as a special interest group, just like every other special interest group that has their own agenda and has long had their own agenda. And it doesn't mean you reject everything they say out of hand, but it means you view it just as skeptically as you'd view something coming from any other group with an agenda. And that to the extent that we are just blindly deferring to intellectual elites on these issues, we're only hurting ourselves. And so that's sort of my takeaway from Sowell's view of how he's perceived. You have to distinguish between how the Black elites perceive him and how, you know, what he's saying or what he's been saying over the decades, how that's viewed by most everyday Black people.
Jason L. Riley, the book is Maverick, A Biology of Thomas Sowell. Thank you very much for joining us this evening and for introducing us to the story behind the man and his ideas. Thank you all for joining us this evening.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.